the hardest day of the retreat is almost over. I mean, the first day really is the most challenging, just settling in, letting the mind quiet down a bit. This morning I spoke a little bit about the Satipatthana Sutta, that is the discourse the Buddha gave on the four foundations of mindfulness. And it's really quite remarkable how in a few short pages the Buddha lays out a whole path of discovery and exploration of every aspect of our Dharma practice. Just out of interest, how many of you have actually read the Satipatthana Sutta? And so you're all familiar with it then. If you recall, the Buddha leads us through, in this very concise way, through an awareness of the breath, of bodily sensations, of feelings, of the mind, of the hindrances, of the factors of enlightenment, of the liberation that comes from an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So it's all contained in this very concise form. And as I mentioned this morning, all the methods, all the techniques of Vipassana are rooted in this one particular sutta. And we'll be exploring over these next days different of these foundations of mindfulness, the different ways of developing mindfulness. But tonight I thought it would be helpful to clarify the meaning of a few very important terms. One of the great challenges of the Dharma coming to the West is that in Pali, in the Pali language, the terms have very specific meanings. When they're translated into English, the English terms that we use as the translations often have a wide variety of meanings. And so unless we're very carefully attuned to what is meant by the Pali terms, it's easy to get confused. For example, terms like consciousness, knowing. How many different ways in English do we use the word to know something? Consciousness, knowing, perception, mindfulness, awareness, wisdom. So these are the terms that I'd like to talk about this evening, so that as we begin the practice, we have a clearer idea of what we're actually practicing. So the first important term is consciousness. In Pali, it's vijnana. So this is the ordinary, ongoing process of knowing the different six sense objects. And knowing sights and sounds and smells and tastes and sensations in the body and mind objects, mind as the sixth sense. And this process of consciousness, of knowing these six objects, is happening in all beings. It's happening in animals as well as humans. It's happening in babies. It's happening in young children. It's happening in adults. For all of us, there's this ongoing process of consciousness or knowing the basic sense experience, knowing an object arising and passing moment after moment throughout our lives. It's interesting just to watch a pet or an animal or a young baby or child and simply to observe that this is what's going on. You know, you can see that all of them are simply knowing these different sense impressions. This is our life unfolding. So a couple of things to understand about this. One is that consciousness and its object always arise simultaneously. It's not that consciousness is waiting for an object. The knowing and object always arise together as a pair. So, for example, the sound and the knowing of it. It's arising exactly at the same time. Not before, not after. How much effort did you need to make to hear the sound? Not much. The knowing of the sound arises spontaneously. We're not doing anything to have the knowing arise. The knowing and object arising together, passing away together. So the second thing that's interesting about this, if one is interested in the mind, is that the knowing and the object cannot be separated. They're arising simultaneously and are inseparable, but they can be distinguished. So we can distinguish the knowing aspect from the object. As an example of this, when you look at this, you see both the color and the form, the shape. You can't separate the two. The color is in a shape, and the shape has a color. So you can't separate them. But these aspects are distinguishable, they're not the same. That's exactly how it is with knowing an object. So we can distinguish knowing, we can distinguish, we can experience what consciousness, what knowing is like, even as it's inseparable from what is being known. We together? Okay. So the second term to understand, the first is consciousness or knowing, and it's simply the most simple knowing of sense impression. That's all consciousness does. The second term to understand, and it has tremendously important implications, is perception. And this is the usual translation of the Pali word sanya. Perception is the quality or the factor of mind that recognizes what the object is. So consciousness just hears the sound. It's just a hearing. It's perception which recognizes the sound as a bell. It picks out what distinguishes this sound from all other sounds. It puts a concept on it, bell, and then it stores it in memory. So we remember that sound as being the sound of a bell in the future. Like consciousness, perception, this quality or factor of recognition, is happening in every moment. It's called a common factor. So just in the ordinary course of our lives, what's happening in the mind is consciousness is running along, arising and passing, knowing different objects, and along with consciousness, perception is arising. And we're recognizing the sound as a bell. We see something, and we recognize it as a man or a woman or a house. So recognition, perception is ongoing. The Buddha gave a lot of emphasis to this factor of perception. He singled it out as being one of the five aggregates of existence. The reason it's so important is because the way we perceive things very much conditions our attitude towards them. Conditions our reactions, it conditions our mind states. So I'll give you just an example of this. A friend of mine was building a house in the States, and it was out kind of in the forested area. And as they were building the house, he saw I don't know if you're familiar with the birds of great blue heron. It's a big, beautiful bird. And he saw a couple of them flying around. And they're really quite something to see. They're quite majestic birds. And so they finished building the house and he moved in. And after a short while, he heard a little chirping sound from the basement. And he thought these great birds must have had chicks, and they're chirping. And it just made him so happy. And then sometime later, a repair person came to the house and needed to do some work in the basement, went down to the basement and came up and said, the smoke alarm is broken and it's making the beeping sound. As soon as the concept changed, the sound became so annoying and he had to have it fixed immediately. Nothing changed except how he was perceiving it. The sound was exactly the same. So this factor of perception, of recognition, has a powerful influence on how we live our lives. The problem is that our perceptions are often inaccurate. Just because we perceive something to be a certain way doesn't mean that that's how it actually is, like with the bird and the smoke alarm. And I had a striking example of this on one retreat. It was my first retreat with Sayadaw Upandita, who maybe you've heard some stories, very fierce, demanding teacher. The course was very, very intense. And I was doing, this was at IMS in Massachusetts. I was doing walking meditation outside and I glanced up and I saw Upandita watching me do the walking. I started walking really slowly. Lifting, moving, placing. And so I'm walking back and forth all the while. He's watching me. But after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I look at, he's still watching. Yeah. So I'm a little uptight about it all. But after about 20 minutes, he was still there watching me. This is odd. So then I looked more carefully. And it wasn't Upandita at all, it was a lampshade. But I had created a whole world in my mind and a whole range of feelings about it, all based on an inaccurate perception. This is a somewhat trivial example, but the Buddha spoke a lot about what he called hallucinations of perception, which are the major hallucinations which keep us in the arena, the field of suffering. So the hallucinations of perceptions that he talked about is when we take what is impermanent to be permanent. We might think, oh, I don't do that. I know things are impermanent. But if we really knew, if we knew deeply and thoroughly that things are impermanent, we wouldn't cling to anything. Right? Do you try to hold on to water running in a stream? No, it's impossible. It just runs through our hands. If we could really see and understand the impermanence of every aspect of experience, we wouldn't cling. So even though we know on some, even perhaps deep level, that things change, there's still quite a bit of hallucination of perception about it. We misperceive a hallucination of perception when we take what is unsatisfying and unreliable to be satisfying and reliable. When we take what is not self to be self. So these are the profound aspects of misperceiving our experience. In the next days, we'll be talking a lot more about these characteristics of experience, of impermanence, of dukkha, of selflessness. But for tonight, I just wanted to highlight this term perception what it means, that is the faculty of recognition, the fact that both, it's always arising, it's arising in every moment, sometimes it's accurate, sometimes it's not accurate. So we need to see that. So this consciousness, this perception, the third important term to understand is mindfulness. Known as, you know, mindfulness is the usual translation of the Pali word sati. And this is the observing power of the mind. And it's often described as that faculty of mind, or that quality of mind that comes face to face with the object. So we're there right, we could say right in front of it, or looking at it directly, looking at it face to face. It's the present moment remembering of what it is that's arising. Usually, as we are developing mindfulness, we give emphasis to mindfulness of the different objects that arise. Right? Mindful of a sight, a sound, a sensation, a smell, a thought. But we can also turn the mindfulness to the knowing itself. We can, it's as if we turn the mindfulness back onto the knowing, back onto the consciousness. And so we can become aware, we can become mindful of consciousness itself and understand its nature. Ordinary is ordinary knowing of sense objects. There's the ongoing recognition of what these different objects are. And this is how we usually go through the day. You know, just taking care of our various responsibilities and engaged in our various activities, we're simply playing out all the patterns of our conditioning. We're knowing and recognizing, acting and reacting. I've given a name to this kind of consciousness. And I had to find a comparable example for Israel, so I talked about this at lunch. I don't know whether this will work or not. Are you familiar with the dog, the golden retrievers? Yeah. So they're really playful, they're really friendly. There's an American, I don't even know if it's slang, it's some made-up word. They're galumping along. You know, they're just galumping here and there. When you look at a golden retriever, first of all, it generally brings, you know, makes us happy just to watch them because they seem to be enjoying themselves. But they're just kind of going around, basically following their nose. You know, just going here and there and here and there. And so they're knowing. They're conscious. They're knowing all the different smells and, you know, sights and sounds. And they're recognizing. You know, they're recognizing what's what. So perception is there. But they don't look terribly mindful. You know, there's not that quality of knowing that they know. They're just in it and being led, you know, by instinct and habit and conditioning. So it's what I call this ordinary way of being, and it's the ordinary way of being not only for golden retrievers. We all have golden retriever consciousness, and unfortunately most of the world is living out of this consciousness. But sometimes, and more frequently, you know, as we practice, we remember what we're doing as we're doing it. We become aware of what's arising. We become aware of the awareness. We know that we're knowing. There's a Native American writer in the States. Her name is Louise Erdrich, and she's a beautiful, beautiful writer. She wrote, "Those powerful moments of true knowledge which we paper over with daily life. But every so often something shatters like ice, and we fall into the river of our own existence. We are aware." And isn't it like that? In these moments of true knowledge, but mostly we are papering them over with our daily life, but every so often something shatters and we just drop in to the river of our existence. We are aware. So as an example of how this, you know, works just in our own experience, think of those times when you go to the cinema, you go to the movies, and are completely absorbed in the story. You know, and feeling happy or sad or excited or afraid or whatever emotions the movie is trying to engage in us. And mostly, if it's a good movie, we're pretty lost in the story. That's why we go to the movies. Which is a little strange. I don't know how much it costs here. Let me pay $7 to become deluded. But we enjoy it. Sometimes, though, have you had the experience of sitting in the movie and you're really absorbed in it, but then something happens and for a moment, at least, it's like we wake up and we become aware that we're watching a movie. That's not the point of going to the movies. But it is an interesting moment because we can have a very real and immediate sense of the difference between being lost in the story and what that feels like, and then being awake or aware to the fact that we're seeing. And my experience is that it's always just a feeling of greater spaciousness. And it's like more wakefulness, more aliveness. So our practice, even on the first day of a retreat, brings us very close to one important insight. And that is, and I think this is true of everyone here, we see how often our minds become absorbed in the stories of our life, in the movies of our minds. Has anybody not seen that today? And this is what's quite remarkable, because whether the retreat is in Israel or in India or in the States, it's exactly the same situation. You know, the beauty of the practice is we see for ourselves the commonality of the human experience, the human mind. It works the same way in everyone. So we begin to see just how often the mind gets lost. Lost in the story, lost in the movies. And the thoughts, the images, the fantasies, the emotions. Gets lost in all the attitudes we have about these experiences. It's as if we hop on these trains of association. You know, it's like we're hooked by one particular thought or feeling. We hop on this train of association and it takes us, and we have no idea where the train is going. And somewhere down the line, we remember and we get off, and we might get off in a completely different mental environment. You know, we're in a totally different space for having taken that ride. Often we call this the wandering mind. But actually, the mind is not wandering. The mind is not going anyplace. It's simply that these objects of mind, thoughts or images or feelings, they're arising in the moment, and we're not aware that they're arising. That's what wandering mind means. It's not that it's going anyplace. It's right here, but we have fallen again into unawareness. We don't know what's arising in the mind. And so we get caught in these stories, in these dramas. Don't underestimate the importance and value of seeing this. Because most people don't know how often their minds wander. If you go up to somebody in the street and you ask, oh, does your mind wander? Oh, no, I'm present, I know what's going on. For people who have not looked inward, who have not really looked to observe their minds, generally they have no idea of how much of the time is lost. They're lost in their own mental activity. And because they don't know, they're not motivated at all to awaken from that dream. So this insight of just how often our mind does this is very important. Mm-hmm. Appreciate the fact that you understand this about your mind. So this is the power of mindfulness. Mindfulness with practice knows what it is that's happening as it's happening. It's a tremendously powerful force on the spiritual journey. And there's a wonderful little teaching by Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche, who was one of the great Tibetan Dzogchen masters of the last century. And I had a chance to study with him a little bit, and he was really quite a remarkable being. And this is from his teaching. He said, mindfulness is the root of Dharma. Mindfulness is the body of practice. Mindfulness is the fortress of the mind. Mindfulness is the aid to the wisdom of innate wakefulness. Lack of mindfulness will allow the negative forces to overcome you. Without mindfulness, you will be swept away by laziness. Lack of mindfulness is the creator of evil deeds. Without mindfulness and presence of mind, nothing can be accomplished. Without mindfulness, you are a heartless zombie, a walking corpse. Dear Dharma friends, please be mindful. By the aspiration of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, may all Dharma friends attain stable mindfulness and ascend the throne of perfect awakening. So that's a wonderful wish and blessing for us. So the question is, why is mindfulness such a powerful force on this path? Why is it given such prominence? Why is it at the heart of our spiritual journey? Unlike perception, which can be colored by greed, by hatred, by delusion, those forces can color our perception. Mindfulness is always wholesome. Not only is it always wholesome, in the Abhidhamma, in the Buddhist psychology, mindfulness is one of the universal wholesome factors, which means that in every wholesome mind state of generosity, of practicing sila, of metta, of compassion, in every wholesome mind state, mindfulness is present. So this is a very strong, powerful factor of mind in terms of developing skillful, wholesome mind states. So here's where the clarification of terms becomes very important. It's easy to confuse perception or recognition with mindfulness. We can be recognizing something and think we're being mindful because we're recognizing it. But it's not necessarily mindfulness. And I'll give you an example of this. This goes back quite a long way in my practice, but I went through a long period of time where the predominant unskillful emotion was fear. I was dealing with a huge amount of fear. And it wasn't fear about anything in particular. It was like the primal energy. It got so bad that if I was sitting, I was afraid to stand. It was completely irrational. That was the energy that was coming up. And this was going on, not continually, but often for months and months and months. I was working with this fear. And I was noting it, and I was thought I was being mindful of it, and you know, but it really felt locked in. And one day on a retreat, having been with it for so long, something shifted in my mind. I was doing walking meditation, and something shifted in my mind, and the shift was expressed in the thought, if this fear is here for the rest of my life, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And that was the first moment that I really accepted it. In all the time before that, I recognized it. I recognized that it was fear, but there was aversion to it. I didn't like it. I wanted it to go away. But I was taking the recognition to be mindful, to be mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. And so I stayed locked into that feeling. Mindfulness is always wholesome. If mindfulness is there, aversion is not present. If mindfulness is there, greed is not present. And so we need to be careful as we're working, especially with, especially with challenging states, but even with very pleasant states. Recognition is not sufficient. That's simply the factor of perception. Mindfulness means something else. The perception will be there, but we have to be there in a certain way. We have to be aware of what's present without attachment, without aversion, without identification. So as we begin to understand what mindfulness is, as distinguished from simply knowing or consciousness, and as distinguished from perception, but as we really learn about the beauty of mindfulness, the wholesomeness, gradually we just relax. We relax into an acceptance of what's arising in the body. We become more intimate with the body, feeling the body just as different sensations of pressure and tightness and vibration and tingling and warmth or coolness. We go from the abstract concept of body to the actual felt sensations. We become mindful of what the body is through our direct experience. Mindfulness also begins to observe not only what it is that's arising, whether it's in the body or in the mind, but mindfulness also begins to notice our attitudes about these experiences. For example, when we check the attitude in the mind about unpleasant physical sensations, you're sitting, you're feeling some pain in the body. What's the attitude in the mind as you're feeling the pain? We want to check that. We want to really look and become aware. Maybe there's fear. Oh, it's okay now, but what's it going to be like in 15 minutes? You know, and we start getting a little anxious about the sensation. So that's coloring the mind. Maybe there's some feeling of self-pity. Everybody here is in blissful samadhi, and I'm struggling with this pain. Sometimes it's just blatant aversion. I hate this, you know, and I wish it would go away. So very often we are aware of the sensations themselves, but we often forget to check the attitude in the mind of how we're holding them, how we're relating to them. And we need to have that check on the attitude if we want to settle into mindfulness. We also need to check the attitude with respect to thoughts. Very commonly, meditators have all kinds of opinions about the presence of thoughts in the mind. Sayadaw Tejaniya, he really speaks a lot about this, and he has some wonderful teaching about it. He said, when the mind is thinking or wandering, just be aware of it. Thinking is a natural activity of the mind. You are doing well if you are aware that the mind is thinking. But if you feel disturbed by thoughts, or if you have a reaction or judgment of them, there is a problem with your attitude. The thinking mind is not the problem. Your attitude that they should not be around is the problem. So understand that you have just become aware of some functions of the mind. These two are just objects for your mindfulness. So this is an important thing to remember. Thoughts are going to come. Many thoughts are going to come. Not a problem if we simply practice being aware of them as quickly as possible when they do come. One way of strengthening mindfulness in our practice, and this is a technique that the Saito Utejaniya has recommended, is to frequently ask the question with regard to any experience that's happening, the breath, a sensation, a thought, to frequently ask the question, what's the attitude in the mind right now? And what's really interesting is that sometimes just by asking the question, it's not even looking for the answer, just by asking the question, there's often a disidentification with whatever attitude might have been there. So, did you follow that? I've noticed this in the most remarkable way. I can be sitting, just feeling the breath. You know, just the most simple. I'm sitting, the mind feels at ease. Just feeling the breath come in, feeling the breath go out. And then sometimes I'll remember to ask the question, well, what's the attitude in my mind regarding this breathing? And it's so interesting. More often than not, I can feel a slight relaxation from a holding or a wanting that I didn't even know was there. You know, I was feeling the breath, and somewhere in the background, being with it in order to become more concentrated, or in order for this, or in order for the breath to slow down, or whatever. Some attitude that I had been unaware of, and which, in a small way, was a source of tension, was a source of suffering. Just by asking the question, what's the attitude? You can feel the mind relax. So it's something I would suggest you experiment with and explore. See if using that question helps you become more aware of these subtle background influences in the mind. There's one feedback that can remind us to check our attitude that I think has been one of the most helpful things for me in my practice. And that is understanding that the feeling of struggle is actually an important piece of information. So whenever we're in our practice and there's some sense of struggle going on, you ever have that? It's to understand that struggle means only one thing. It only means that something is arising in our experience that we're not accepting. Because if we were accepting of it, we wouldn't be struggling. So instead of seeing the struggle as a problem or as something we have to battle with, rather take it as this piece of information telling us, oh, something is arising here that I'm not open to. And a very simple way of discovery in these situations is to sit back and ask the question, what's happening? What's arising? Maybe it will be some discomfort in the body that we've been trying to avoid and kind of trying to push away, you know, trying to be with the breath, but the discomfort or pain is really calling. If we don't attend to it, if we don't open to it, we're in a state of struggle. Maybe it will be some background mood or emotion that's arising that we're not aware of. And there's a sense of struggle. Maybe there'll be a flood of thoughts going on. And if we're not open to that experience, if we have the idea, this shouldn't be happening, I should be with my breath, there's going to be a struggle. So take this as feedback. It's a way of settling back into the moment and relaxing and opening to whatever it is that's present. That's what being mindful means. Sometimes people feel somewhat discouraged or impatient when they realize meditation is not all bliss. It's not all pleasant feelings. And I smile because you're all, you know, experienced meditators, and we think we know this. You know, we've certainly had enough experience of meditation being difficult at times and unpleasant at times, so we think we know, yeah, that's what meditation is. But how often do we assess our meditation? If we have a sitting and it's been pleasant, oh, I had a good sitting. You know, if it was really painful or there was boredom or, you know, some different, oh, that was really a bad sitting. Even though we know better on one level, it's very usual to use pleasant or unpleasant as the measure of our sitting, good and bad. So we want to become aware of this because it's the wrong measure. You know, and we just create a lot more trouble for ourselves when that's the measure we use. Our practice is deepening when we can actually feel and be open to whatever is arising, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. Again, Saito Utejani had great words about this. He said, you have to accept and watch both pleasant and unpleasant experience. You only want pleasant experience. You don't want even the tiniest unpleasant experience. Is this fair? Is this the way of the Dharma? So it's just to watch. There's a strong tendency in the mind. You know, we want to become mindful of that. There's one teaching of the Buddha it always makes me sit up straight because it's so uncompromising. Where he said, as long as there's attachment to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant, liberation is impossible. There's a little work to do. These conditioned reactions are very deep, very strong. Attachment to the pleasant, aversion to the unpleasant. It's the practice of mindfulness which begins to decondition that response. Unpleasant, fine. We're just mindful that it's unpleasant. We're open to it. We're with it. Pleasant, fine. We're mindful that it's pleasant without attachment, without grasping. So there's consciousness, there's perception, there's mindfulness. The fourth term is wisdom. And it's kind of interesting that mindfulness is a common wholesome factor, which means it's present in every wholesome mind state. Wisdom is not. We can be mindful without wisdom. And so mindfulness, although necessary, is not sufficient. So it's not enough simply to be mindful. We have to use the mindfulness as the platform, as the foundation for then investigating. As we're mindful, as we come face to face with experience, we need to, not literally, but hold the question in the mind, what am I learning from being mindful? And so wisdom is this investigative factor, and that's the purpose that mindfulness serves. We've talked some about how mindfulness serves wisdom. Then we talk about going from the concept of my back, which is perception, to the actual sensations that we feel of pressure or tightness or pulsing. And then to begin to see, oh, these sensations are always changing. We're learning something from being mindful of them. So that's the factor of wisdom at work. Wisdom arises when we're learning from, we might feel unpleasant sensations. Wisdom investigates what's the nature of that pain. You put your hand in fire, you don't want to simply be mindful, burning, burning, burning. Wisdom says, take your hand out of the fire. That's the wisdom factor. Can't remember actually what time I got here with my glasses. Compress things a little bit. Wisdom also comes into play in a most interesting way when we become mindful of thoughts. Okay, so what happens in our usual experience? We're going along, we're with the breath, we're with the body, with sounds. Thought arises very often. We're lost in the thought for some period of time, and then at a certain point we wake up from being lost. That moment of waking up from being lost is really important. Don't overlook it, and don't rush back to some other experience, because right in that moment of going from being lost in a thought to being awake, to being mindful that you're thinking, that reveals the nature of mindfulness. Right there, we are experiencing the awake mind. So really look at the quality of that. What is the mind like in that moment of awareness? Investigate, bring wisdom to bear in that moment. The tendency is one of two things. We're lost in a thought, and then we wake up, and we either just rush back to whatever object we were attending to, or we get further lost in a judgment about having been lost. Oh, there I am, lost again. Totally useless. Instead of judging ourselves for having been lost in thought, why not take delight in the fact of having awakened? Because for as many times as you get lost in thought in a day, 10 million times, that many times do you awaken. At some point, you become aware that you're thinking. If you take delight in the moment of awakening, rather than judge the fact of being lost, you'll have 10 million moments of delight. It really awakens a much different sense of interest and engagement with our minds, with our practice, with thought. It ceases to be a problem. So we become mindful, and maybe it's after the thought is already over, maybe in the middle, maybe sometimes right in the beginning. So we're lost, and then we're awake. Once we're mindful of thought, then we bring wisdom to bear to investigate. And this is one of the most, for me, interesting aspects of the meditation practice. When we're mindful enough to know that we're thinking, to then ask the question or hold the question in the mind, what is a thought? Not what is the thought saying, but what is a thought as a phenomenon? It's incredibly interesting. Here's this phenomenon that happens countless times a day that, when unnoticed, has a huge and often coercive power in our lives. Thoughts are like little dictators in the mind. You know, go here, go there, do this, do that, and we just follow along. And this was kind of a little useless activity, but people are acting on thoughts in the world that create huge amount of suffering. Thoughts motivated by greed and by fear and by hatred. So this is not some insignificant thing. Thoughts, when they're unnoticed, have this tremendous power. And for most people, they are mostly unnoticed. But what's so amazing is that when we do become aware of the thought and look into its nature, it's little more than nothing. It's just this kind of tiny little energy blip, this slight energy arising in the mind. When we're aware of it, we see how transparent, how empty, how insubstantial it is. So to learn this about our minds is tremendously freeing. Because basically our thoughts, when unnoticed, drive us crazy. And when we do notice them, we see there's nothing much there. And so the mind learns to abide in a place of tremendous ease. So this is from Khenpo Rinpoche, also one of the great Tibetan masters. He said, "When a rainbow appears, we see many beautiful colors. Yet a rainbow is not something we can clothe ourselves with or wear as an ornament. It simply appears through the conjunction of various conditions. Thoughts arise in the mind in just the same way. They have no tangible reality or intrinsic existence at all. There is therefore no logical reason why thoughts should have so much power over us, nor any reason why we should be enslaved by them. Once we recognize that thoughts are empty, the mind will no longer have the power to deceive us. But as long as we take our deluded thoughts as real, they will continue to torment us mercilessly, as they have been doing through countless lives." So what we're doing here, you know, has profound implications for ourselves and for the world. As we understand the difference between consciousness, just golden retriever consciousness, you know, and the perception that goes along with it, and then we begin to understand what mindfulness means, that we actually can be mindful of what's arising. And then we use the mindfulness as the platform for wisdom to investigate what we're seeing. We really have the opportunity to free ourselves from those forces in the mind that create so much suffering. And as Patricia mentioned last night, we also learn that we're doing this not for ourselves alone, but we can dedicate our practice and our understanding to the benefit and the welfare and the happiness of all beings. Let's just sit for a couple of moments.